complete program. So it's the topic that we are going to discuss for the next 1 week is the Vedantic way of life. So I think we will have 1 hour, 1 full hour discussion, I mean lecture, and then 30 minutes interaction. Of course, interaction may be very important in this context, because I am going to introduce not only Vedantic philosophy and Vedantic concepts, but also the Vedic way of life, which constitutes the background, the foundation of Vedanta philosophy and Vedantic way of life. Now, Vedanta itself means the conclusion, the final word, or the essence of Vedas. So, Vedana Antaha, that is, or Vedasya Antaha. If you use the plural, Vedana Antaha. If you use the singular, Vedasya Antaha. It means the end of the Vedas, the conclusion of the Vedas. And Anta, the word, also means the essence, the gist, the core. So, not only the conclusion or the last word, but also the essence, the gist, the core of Vedic philosophy is designated by this term Vedanta. There is a huge literature on Vedanta philosophy and Vedantic way of life. The background, the foundation of Vedanta philosophy and Vedantic way of life is Vedas. As many most of you know, I shall just give a word view. Vedas constitute the foundational literature of Vedanta philosophy, Vedanta way of life, everything related to Vedas and everything related to Hinduism is found in the Vedic literature. Vedas are altogether 4 in number: Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, and Athar Veda. According to tradition, Vedas used to be one single text. Later on, one great scholar called Vyasa divided the entire Vedic literature into 4 groups or 4 classes, 4 categories. Classified them into 4 groups. They are called Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, and Athar Veda. Of which Rig Veda is the largest, the most important, and the most ancient. Incidentally, it is known to be the most ancient human record of ancient way of life. To give a comparison, it is said to be at least 4,000 years older than the Book of the Dead, that is the ancient book of the Egyptians, which is supposed to be the second oldest after Vedic literature. Now, as I said, Rig Veda is the largest and also most important. That's because many of the hymns, many of the important passages and hymns of the Rig Veda are found in the other 3 Vedas also. So what Vyasa did was this: he edited and classified the Veda into 4 groups and taught each group to each one of his 4 disciples. Just giving a background. He taught Rig Veda to one of his disciples, who was also a great sage, called Paila. Sama Veda he taught Jaimini. Yajur Veda he taught to Vaishambhayana. And Athar Veda he taught to another disciple, Sumantra. This is the story. This is the background. Now, coming back to Vedanta, the way of life, that's the topic of discussion for our retreat. You know, when we talk about way of life, we have to think of the day-to-day life situation, the family life, which is essentially the core of social and national life. How people used to live in families, what was the nature of relationship between parents and children, between brothers and brothers, sisters and sisters, and also the other aspect, what was the relationship which students had with their teacher, and what was the concept of studentship, what was the concept of teacher, who was an ideal teacher in Vedic times, and what were some of the fundamental values which determined Vedic way of life. To begin with, I would like to make a statement. If you get a clear picture of Vedic way of life, and if you compare the way of life that existed during the early Vedic period, and compare it with what it is today, you find human civilization, human culture has come backward, has degraded. But I would say, as civilization has progressed, culture has gone backward. Many of the natural human weaknesses, drawbacks in thinking, for example, religious fanaticism, intolerance of other people's views, conflicts in the name of castes in the context of India, races in the context of many Western countries, and classes on the basis of economic or official position. All these were almost absent in Vedic way of life. Yeah, if those of you who may not have access to Rigveda Samhita, the original Vedic literature, and also the commentary in Sanskrit is called some of these Yaskas Niruktam, which is a small commentary, more like a dictionary, and also Sayana's commentary, elaborate commentary on the literature, which of course he wrote around 11th century, 12th century. If you, those of you who do not have access to this original verse in Sanskrit, can read Bharati Vidya Bhavan's volumes, the early Vedic age, and you get a picture of the way of life. It was so egalitarian, and it was so democratic, and something very interesting that may be of interest, especially in America, this perfect gender equality. And there was absolutely no fanaticism, intolerance in the name of creeds, castes, groups of faith and worship and so on. That is a unique feature of Vedic way of life. It is democratic, it is spiritual, and it is egalitarian, and it is based on the principles of gender equality, equality in all respects. And there was no temple worship, no image worship. The type of the huge temples that that came up in India in later centuries, the elaborate forms of formal worship, all these were totally absent during the early Vedic period. Religion for somebody living in Vedic age meant to go to a teacher who may be living in a hermitage in a forest, sit under his feet, help him in his day-to-day activities, and learn the Vedas, and meditate, meditating on the nature of the absolute reality, the truth behind the whole existence. And when the teachers taught the students, they often used parables and imageries and examples from open nature. So those of Western Orientalists like Keith MacDonald, even Max Muller, Winter Nietzsche, Kohlberg, and many other great European Orientalists who worked very hard right from the later half of 18th century and all through 19th century, right up to the 40s of 20th century, who worked very hard to study the Vedas, have sometimes interpreted Vedic religion as pantheistic. And that's because they gave a purely philological and linguistic interpretation of Vedic literature and not a philosophical interpretation. With one great grand example, it's a great German orientalist who was Paul Deussen, who went to India to study Sanskrit Vedas and the great traditional teachers, and he imbibed Vedic wisdom right from the great teachers who belonged to the ancient tradition of teacher-student succession. This is called Guru Shishya Parampara, which is called in old Sanskrit tradition. Now, to begin with, I shall just read a convocation address from Vedic literature. It comes in the Taittiriya Upanishad, which is a part of Yajurveda. So, this branch of Yajurveda was taught by Vyasa to one of his disciples called Vaishnavayana. So, this is a convocation address. It gives a picture. In those days, parents used to send their children to a great teacher living in some distant hermitages. Mostly, these hermitages were located in today's Punjab, Haryana, western and northern UP, mostly in the Himalayan regions, extreme northern part of it. Rishikesh, Himalaya, Badrinath, Kedarnath, Haridwar, and also in what is now today known as Afghanistan, and in today's Pakistan, that's West Punjab, East Punjab, and mostly into Gangetic Plain. So many of these places were wooded forest in those days. The most ancient city, the most famous city of Vedic times was Kashi, which many of our friends have visited perhaps some of them. So the city continues to be a sacred city in India. So the point is, these teachers mostly lived and taught in the forest hermitages. And these teachers were not all of them monks. They were not all of them world-renouncing monks. They were mostly retired people. So in those days, I have to say something about this before opening this convocation address in the Taittiriya Upanishad. In those days, the concept of what we should call, four asamas means four stages of four orders of planned religious life. It's called chadurasama, four asamas, four stages of life, planned life. Not necessarily spiritual evolution. Frequently, it was also a kind of planned life in an ascending order based on the cultural and spiritual growth of a person. So it's called Brahmacharya Garhasthya Vanaprastha Sannyasa. In Sanskrit, it's called, in English, the first period was the period of studentship. Every child used to be educated, not only boys but even girls. So there is a statement in the Yajurveda that Brahma Sardhyena He Kanyam Yuvanam Pravijaya means a young woman used to get a husband appropriate to her position in Vedic learning. So you'll be just surprised. During the later periods of evolution in Indian society, there was negative women folk. In the Smritis you find the statements. In the later texts, during the post-Vedic periods, many injustices later crept into Hindu society. If you compare that picture of Hindu society, see around right from maybe 2nd century AD onwards, if you compare that with the social life of ancient Vedic times, you'll be just shocked to what extent society sometimes comes backward as time goes forward. So this happens. So yatra narishta pujyante tatra deva ramanti cha yatra yadastuna pujyante tatra sarva phala kriya is a statement. It comes in the Manu's code. It's called Manu's Smriti. It's all constitutions. There were 18 important constitutions in ancient India. Were the lawgivers of whom Manu was the most prominent one. He may have lived there maybe around 7th or 8th century BC. So he says, where women are honored, everything goes all right. Where they are not properly respected, everything goes in vain. But in the same Smriti elsewhere, the same Manu says, women should be kept under control. Asuvandra sthriyakarya purushai swayar divanisham vyasayeshu sajasajindya samsthapya atmanavasya. I'm just giving a picture before I enter the subject. Because Vedantic way of life can be understood if you get an overall picture of the sociological, cultural and anthropological aspects of Vedic way of life, which is the foundation of Vedantic way of life. So sometimes during the later centuries, you know, restrictions came, crept into social structure. So the point is, both boys and girls used to be sent to forest hermitages to be taught by saints and sages who had already gone through the earlier two stages of life. That means they are already, they themselves had studied the Vedas at least 12 years, right from 12th year to 24th year, and then they must have married, which is a period of householdership. It's called Garhastya, the second stage of human life. And when they see the face of the grandchildren, or when they see their hairs getting grey and their face getting wrinkled, instead of going to beauty parlor, trying to blacken the hair and whiten the teeth and trying to rehearse the metabolic evolution of metabolism, what they do? They used to retire to forest hermitages, both husband and wife, and spend the rest of their lifetime in contemplation, meditation on higher spiritual land. I mean, what is the age, what is the end of human life? Because they have already gone through the three stages of life. Studentship, Brahmacharyasrama. Then the period of being an householder, husband and wife. And the third stage, when they already got aged, when they have made sure that their family's tradition will continue, because they only see the face of the grandchildren, they used to leave their homes, both husband and wife, go into forest hermitages and spend the rest of the lifetime in meditation contemplation. It is called Vanaprasthasrama. Many of the teachers were these Vanaprasthas, means those who are retired from their active social family obligations. A retired forest spent the rest of the lifetime in contemplation. So, here I am going to quote one passage from the Daitriya Upanishad. It is translated into simple, informal language, English. It's a convocational test. So, here a student who may be a girl or a boy, we don't know, after having gone through this period of education in the forest hermitage, is retiring, going back to his or her home. Now, he or she must have studied the Vedas, must have got the theoretical knowledge of what it means to be an ideal husband, or an ideal wife, or sister, or brother, or a citizen of the country, member of society. He may have got a theoretical understanding of what it means, but he should be given a practical knowledge of what it means to be an ideal member of the family. That's the topic of discussion here. So, and remember, in Vedic scheme of life, there was not so much of emphasis on asceticism, which is frequently a chant that is leveled against Vedic way of life. It is a total misinterpretation. If you read any of these books available in English, reliable books, written by people who studied the Vedas, mind you, I can recommend one book is maybe the first volume of the Cultural Heritage of India, published by the Ramakrishna Mission. It contains some good articles written by scholars. And another equally reliable work is the Bharati Vidya Bhavan's series of volumes on history and culture of Indian people. The first two volumes are very wonderful documents which give you a graphic description of Vedic way of life. Now, there was so much of emphasis on practical life situations centering around family and the sanctity of family relationship. The respect that a child, son or a daughter, were maybe, should show to her his parents, the respect, honor he should give to his teacher, and how, after going through this education, he should practice what he has studied in the practical life situation of the family. So all these are given. So I shall just say, Vedam anuchya acharya andevasinam anishastra, which means, after having taught the Vedas, the teacher is instructing the pupil, the student. That's why this is a kind of convocation address. After completing the whole education program, the student is going back to his parents. Frequently, one interesting thing that you find in the Vedic literature is, a very learned father may not teach his own son all the shastras, may not impart all the learning. Sometimes a very learned sage may send his son to a distant hermit, far away, to learn. The reason is, the father gives all the education, father may be prejudiced sometimes because he's his own son or daughter. So he may not give, at least while teaching some branches of learning, he may not be fully impartial. So to make it very objective and rational, frequently you find learned sages, parents, used to send their children to the distant hermits. But here, so a student, after completing his education, is going back to his home. The beginning of education used to be called Upanayanam, which is frequently, some of you must have heard, they put the sacred thread, which is symbolic of that. Sacred thread ceremony, it is called. And returning home, it used to be called Samavartana, means going back after completion. His teaching, Satyam Vada, at the first instruction, you should speak the truth, which is obvious enough. Dharmam Chara, you should practice Dharma. Now, Dharma has got many dimensions, many different types of implications. Dharma could mean righteousness. In its most simple elementary sense, it could mean righteousness, the right thing to do, the right thing to practice, the right thing to say, and so on. But it also means you should act and live and do things in such a way that it should not violate the existing rhythm, the existing order of the world. We should not do anything that upsets the balance of collective social family life. So any act, in a being act in the physical sense, it could be a word, it could be a thought, it could be anything, should be in conformity with dharma. It should be done in such a way that it doesn't violate the inner harmony and rhythm of life, either in the family setting or in the social context or the national context. So in those days, anybody who violates nature was considered to be a practitioner of adharma, the opposite of dharma. And the third instruction, Swadhyayan Ma Pramadaha, means you should never deviate, you should never neglect the practice of reading what you have already studied. So daily reading of what we have already studied, because what we study in schools may be just 1/4 of what we should understand from those books. Frequently, we get only 1/4, that's one view of ancient Vedic sages. From teachers, we get only 1/4. In school, when we study a book, or when we try to master a branch of learning, we are able to learn only 1/4 of the total wisdom. The other 4, we learn from discussion with fellow students or with others in general. And the third 1/4, gradually we learn. And the last one we learn when we become fully mature. So from teachers, from our effort, from discussion for this, and finally gradually we get a full understanding of what we learn. We need a teacher who should introduce a branch of learning to us. Then we must make our own effort. That we must also discuss with others, maybe with fellow students. But that's not enough. We reach the highest level of perfection in learning only when we ourselves become more mature. You often find this happening in our own life. When we read a book of, say, religious, spiritual scripture, Gita or Bible or anything, sometimes the amount of wisdom that we imbibe by reading depends upon our own level of intellectual maturity, not only intellectual, but spiritual maturity. So as we grow older, not in age alone, because there are many people who grow only in age, even I think tends to grow growing, you just grow old. If we can't help anyone. So, growing in wisdom is an important point mentioned here. That's a real implication of Swadhyaya Ma Pramadaha, which means you should never neglect, never deviate from the daily practice of reading scriptures. Any scripture for the matter, that is, that elevates us, that teaches, that inspires us. Because we cannot learn everything from the school, we cannot learn everything from our human effort alone, and we cannot learn everything by discussion, but gradually as we grow in wisdom, as we evolve in wisdom, we also learn more and more from what we have studied maybe 10 years back. When we read a book 10 years back, we may have got an idea, but today if you read, suddenly you get new dimensions of thoughts and wisdom creeping in the mind. So that's a true implication of Swadhyaya Ma Pramadaha. And then, this is one part. The second one is that that is related to the lifestyle of those times. Acharyaya priyam dhanam ahruti prajatantum ma vivachitsi. This one's here. Now, there was a view in ancient times. You should not learn anything free from anyone. Now, suppose we get everything free without any effort. We won't care a damn for those things. You find when you have to pay fees, huge tuition fees, sometimes taking money from banks, mortgaging. Then we go out of the way to do justice to the amount of sacrifices, the struggle the parents have put for financing or education. When we also have to work hard for getting education, then also we try to do full justice, the whole process of education. So that's why in ancient times there is a very interesting principle. When you study something, you should pay back something. It could be in the form of service. Service, not money alone. Dhanam is mentioned here. The word mentioned here is dhanam. Because in those days, dhanam did not mean currency notes. In those days, dhanam meant, of course, in Vedic times, the currency was horses, gold, and elephants, and service. These were the So, students used to come from different places of Indian continent. You may remember, you know, there were two ancient universities in India. One was the Takshashila, which was founded around 9th century or 1 million BC, which became extinct by 2nd century AD. There's another university which promoted Buddhism and other branches of learning, which was founded around 1st century AD and which was destroyed by the Muslim invaders, Mongol Bhakti Akhilji, around 13th century AD. In fact, students from Fujian, Yuanshan, from China, Japan, Cambodia, Alexandria, all used to flock into Nalanda University. So according to historians, there were tens of thousands of students, which is right now located near Patna in Bihar. And they are already trying to revive the ancient Nalanda University, which is the cradle of Buddhist learning. So which attracted students from all over the non-civilized world, including Greece and Turkey. So they are trying to revive this an international body of academics who are struggling to try to revive the ancient Nalanda University. So this was the later university, but in the early times, before these universities were founded, students used to flock to the Vedic teachers and hermitages. So what will they give? So what they used to do was this. As I said earlier, there were no temples of image worship or elaborate puja rituals in those times. But they used to do fire sacrifices every day. They used to lit fire and uttering sacred mantras. They used to offer milk, ghee, and so on. That is a practice of religious life in those times. The students had to go around and collect twigs for the fire. So these twigs they had to collect. That was the dhanam. So what they sometimes used to give to the teacher was collecting twigs every day. Few twigs thrown around the forest and keep. So the point is, you should either pay back in vittam, is money, vidya, or if you learn one branch of learning from one teacher, then you should teach him some other branch of learning in return, or you should do some service. Then only our learning, what we learn from the teacher, will become fruitful. Because if we get anything free, we won't care for it. We won't consider this as something precious or valuable. And that will, we may not make proper use of any learning that we get free without any effort on our part. So that's one thing. Another point is this prajatantumma vivacchesi. And then mostly the students were expected to go back to their homes, and then they used to marry. And then through marriage, being a householder, they will continue their family tradition, family tree will continue, genealogical tree. And they, when they themselves become old, they should retire to forests and continue the same education. What they have learned from their teacher, they should teach their disciples. This is a very interesting principle in those times. So what we learn from a teacher, we should teach others. So the best way to pay back to a teacher is to teach what you learn from him or her to another student, to other students, so that this tradition of learning will be preserved and continued. This learning, this tradition will not become extinct. So if you go to places where Vedic civilization prevailed, you find dance forms. Many of the dance forms that you sometimes find, music, ancient music, all these were taught by teachers to the students, and they taught their students and so on. So that's why you find here, you know, you should not break that succession, the threat of succession. That's another aspect of Vedic way of life. Satyana pramadidavyam, dharmana pramadidavyam, kusilana pramadidavyam. We should never deviate from the principles of truthfulness and dharma rightfulness. Another interesting thing, kushalatna pramadidavya. Listen, kushala means all these ideas have been elaborately commented upon and explained by Shankaracharya, the great commentator on these verses. Otherwise, we would have got only the elementary meaning. So, commentator will tell you, whatever we are supposed to do to preserve the sanctity of family relationship, the harmony in social life, the harmony in family life, all those duties and responsibilities should be performed with diligence, and we should never be indifferent in the performance of our duties and responsibilities. So work for its own sake, that the commentator will tell you. Duty for its own sake. It's a very interesting teaching we find here. Now, Adbhutena Pramadidavyam, Swadhyaya Pramadidavyam na Pramadidavyam. You find all this. One should never neglect the duties and responsibilities related to the maintenance and preservation of family, society and nation. One interesting aspect of this is, one should work for material prosperity. It is not neglected. But while working for material prosperity, secular prosperity, we should always try to hold fast to the fundamental principles of dharma. In this context, you have to remember the four fundamental values which in later times became the cornerstone of Vedantic way of life, Vedanta, practical Vedanta, Vedanta in real life. As I said, once I mentioned earlier, dharma, artha, kama and moksha. It's called Chaturvidha Purusharthas. It means four fundamental or core principles that should dominate our actions, that should constitute the philosophy of our life. The foundational principle is dharma. So dharma I already explained. Dharma is something that brings harmony, peace and stability in social and family life. Anything that disturbs, that brings in disharmony or disturbance in social or family life is the opposite of dharma. Dharyate iti dharma, that is Sanskrit definition. That which preserves, or that which helps you to preserve great values of life, that is dharma. Now, this is a foundational principle. The first one, the last fourth principle is moksha. Moksha literally means liberation. That's literal meaning. But it has got many other implications. Moksha is the highest transcendental value. Now, you can see this four principles, a set of four principles. At the bottom, the foundational principle, dharma. At the top, you can find moksha, liberation. So, dharma and liberation. Between these two, there are two other principles, which are artha and kama, which are related to life in this world, practical life. Not the life of ascetics or friars or monasteries. Life, I mean values, which are related to our practical life situations, everyday life. Artha here means anything that we want. Certain means, we need money, we need organization, we need science and technology, we need leadership skills. All these are necessary for bringing stability in our everyday life, social life and family life. So the importance of the principle of dharma in family life is emphasized on this point. It's a very crucial point. That's why he said the early Vedic society in many ways was so egalitarian and so relatively free from disharmony and disturbances and frictions. At the bottom, as a foundational principle, is dharma. I mean, anything, the fundamental value, or anything that preserves the harmony, the stability, the sanctity of life, kinship, relationship between parents and children, between brothers and brothers, sisters and sisters, and so on. All these are included in that, dharma. Now, as I said earlier, the second and third value, artha and kama, means or tools for achieving what we want to achieve. Kama means desire, what we want to enjoy. Every ordinary person will have ambitions, goals, plans, ideals in life which he or she wants to achieve. We may be to become a big man in society or any whatever. Maybe to become a very rich man, maybe a big scientist, whatever. Maybe. For all this, he needs some tools. If he wants to be a scientist, you should go to university. If you want to be a rich man, you must be able to know how to finance, how to invest money properly. And if you want to become a prominent politician, then also you need certain skills. Now, while trying to achieve these skills which enable us to achieve the goal, we should not do any foul play. We should stick to dharma. We should not do anything that is opposite to the principles of dharma. That's why dharma is considered to be the foundational, the core principle of Vedantic or Vedic way of life. Life in this world. We are not here talking about the ascetic life, we are talking about life in our everyday common life situation. So, while trying to achieve our goals, we need certain means, and while acquiring the means, wealth, for example, for business, or high education for a person who wants to be a scientist, whatever it may be. he or she has to go through a process which enables a person to achieve the goal that she or he has in mind. For that, he should not try, he should never deviate from the path of dharma. Frequently you find in human life, we work very hard, but finally something happens, everything gets upset. If you look far, you understand there is something wrong in the way in which we acquire the means to achieve that. So sometimes we work hard, and maybe consciously or unconsciously we may play some foul game also. Sometimes playing against the rules of the book, sometimes going against the principles of dharma. So that deviation from the principles of dharma is a tricky point. That deviation enables an Achilles heel to grow within the system. It defeats its own purpose, right? That's why achieving the goal by any means is a self-defeatist plan. If means are proper, then the goal will naturally be achieved. If the means are not proper, if they're improper, for all practical purposes, on paper everything will be fine. But something goes wrong. It could be in the form of a personal tragedy. It could be in the form of an unexpected, unknown problem of which we have no control. And at that moment, we start thinking, what went wrong? And if you analyze in a very superficial way, you won't be able to trace what has gone wrong. Because everything, on paper, everything is fine. But there was something wrong in the way we tried to achieve the tool, the means to achieve the goal. And that wrong method defeated the overall purpose. So we may win the battle but lose the war, as it happens. So that's it, there's an important point is made here. Artha and karma. Alright, in Vedic, the Vedantic scheme of life, every individual was free to achieve, to strive for her or his material goal. Nothing wrong in acquiring money for an ordinary person. Rather, it is a statement in one of the Smritis, one of the ancient constitutions. An householder who does not try to acquire wealth through proper means to support his family and to pay taxes to the king, to help the downtrodden society. Such an householder is practicing adharma, meaning the opposite of dharma, the same ministry. So negligence towards one's own material prosperity is a great crime for an householder. That's an important thing to remember. You know, that's why often those who have not studied the Vedas, sometimes they study some big ascetic principles of Vedanta. They will say, oh, Hinduism talks about other Vedanta, talks about some transcendental something, without giving any regard, any importance to problems life in this world. So highly is kind of life negating. It's a kind of over ascetic philosophy of life, which is purely negative. No, actually, ancient Vedic way of life was very positive. If you read the Rigveda Samhita, you don't find a picture of misery or depression or anything. It's a picture of a very happy, very manly, very valiant, very prosperous life, social life, that you find in Veda Samhita. But this prosperity was based on dharma. As I said earlier, you know, can you imagine? I'm coming to that later. See, how we can keep this harmony in family structure. That point will not be clear unless I read the later part of this paragraph. Matru Devo Bhava, Pitru Devo Bhava, Acharya Devo Bhava, Atithi Devo Bhava. The four instructions that a teacher gives to students who is going back to his home, who stayed away from his home for 12 years, after getting his degree, maybe PhD degree in our terms today, is going back to his home to get a job, to make money, and to marry. And the teacher tells him, Matru Devo Bhava. The first instruction related to family life is, your mother should be like God for you. It means you should honor and respect your mother as much as you respect and honor God himself. It's a kind of state. Let your mother be God to you. That's literally how it is. You can imagine how dharma can be preserved, how dharma here becomes a kind of stabilizing, harmonizing, cementing factor that enables you to achieve and enjoy material prosperity without friction, without depression, without dumping old people in old age homes. And there they're spending the last days watching Terminator 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. So you find it here. So, Matru Devo, let your mother be as respectable, honorable to you as God himself. It means you should never neglect your duties and responsibilities towards your parents. Pitru Devo Bhava, the first place is given to mother. That's something very interesting. Because it's a mother who is the central point of family life. There is a statement in Manu's code, constitutions, Manu's Smriti it is called. The statement is, it means like the statement is this: the respect that you give to your mother should be 100,000 times as much as the respect you should give to your father. So, you know, I don't quote this Smritis every time. So, Sagasraena Adhigam Madhu Gauravena Adhirichyade. That's the later part of my statement. So, the point is this. The respect and honor, the high place, the position that you give to your mother should be 1,000 times the respect you give to your father. So that's why it is stated, let your mother be as respectable to you as God himself. Second statement is Pitru Devo Bhava. These are four important instructions directly related to Vedic and Vedantic way of life. Acharya Devo Bhava, that means your teacher should be respected. Actually, you find, if you look at the history of the great scientists, the great men of distinction, women of distinction, you always find a great mother behind or a great teacher. You won't find a single great person anywhere in the world. You may have heard of Napoleon. Napoleon was small, tiny, you know, too small in size compared to his fellow students. Once the teachers, one of his teachers gave him a mathematical problem, and the class was over, the school was closed, and the child did not return home, and the mother went in search of the child, and teacher and mother both found him solving the problem somewhere sitting in the classroom. And he became a favorable student to his teacher, and also mother. So you find the world has not produced a single great man or woman without either a great mother or a great teacher, either of them or both of them, behind him, who molded his or her life. So that's why the Vedi says, gives instruction, Matradevo Bhava, Pitradevo Bhava, respective father and respective teacher. And then Adidevo Bhava, Aditi means a person who visits our home without giving previous notice. If we give previous notice, diplomatically we can arrange all arrangements depending upon his position. But suppose a person visits our home without giving previous notice, information. Anamantridaha agataha adhideha, this is Sanskrit definition. A person who comes uninvited, unexpected. If then we say adhideva, an ideal household, instructions are given to householders, should be able to treat that guests with the same respect and honor that he or she would give to God himself. Let that guest be God to you, literally. So you get a glimpse of the Vedic way of life, is the foundation, the background of the Vedantic way of life. Now we will have half an hour interaction. So those of you who are interested are welcome to come forward, ask questions, try to answer.
Swami, didn't you say that there were four instructions?
Four instructions.
So, honor mother as God, the teacher must be respected.
Second one is, let your father be Pitradeva.
Okay.
First mother, then father, then teacher, then guest.
Okay.
That's four instructions. That's it.
In the Vedic times, ancient times, you said that the formal ritual was limited and that the elaborate temples didn't yet exist. But in the richness of their experience, were their lives full of informal ritual?
No. You know, the early Vedic age, religious life mostly centered around fire sacrifices. So they were Indra, Varuna, Agruna, Agni. Different natural forces were deified. They were elevated to deities. So in the Rigveda Samhita, the most ancient fundamental book, there are innumerable gods and goddesses mentioned. Many of them are described as the guiding deities of different natural forces. That's how they are described. But the practice of religious life was mostly in the form of instruction, and then students were trained to sit in meditation, self-control, those things. So it was not really pantheism or panitheism. Which are more or less, pantheism implies in equating God with nature. Pantheism implies that you recognize an inherent residing deity in all natural forces. So it was in a way neither of this. There was always an attempt to look towards the transcendental through these empirical natural
phenomena. Yes, Swami, you mentioned only three of the ashramas. I mean,
Brahmachari,
Grihastha, Vipassana. What about sannyas?
Yeah, I'm coming to that. Because this particular paragraph doesn't deal with sannyas, so I'm coming to that. The sannyas are some of the fourth. So, sannyasa as an institution, with formal rituals, all these ceremonies, all these Indian context, was first organized by Buddha. Buddha is the first great organizer of the sannyasa ideal in an organized way, systematic way. Though sannyasins and sannyasa ideal was there all the time, long before Buddha, in Rigveda, you find many monks and all that. But then, as a monastic order, it was Buddha who first founded, organized monasticism in Indian context. In Vedantic context, it was Shankaracharya, who came in 8th century AD. He was the one who, what he did, you know, that again, remember, there were hundreds of monks all over the Indian subcontinent studying and teaching these Vedas and all that. But what Shankaracharya did was, he organized them all under 10 orders, monastic orders. So in a way, he is not the creator of monasticism. He is the organizer of the monks into 10 monastic orders. And he was the one who wrote fundamental books, doctrines, rules and regulations, what we must study, what are the rules, all this was he who did. But in Indian history, it was Buddha who is the originator of organized monasticism. There were monks everywhere. And again, these hermits, to the end of their life, they used to take sannyas. I mean, they used to take monastic life renunciation. Both husband and wife. After some years of contemplative life, mostly they were engaged in teaching, imparting Vedic wisdom. So many of the great teachers were all these retired householders, living in forest hermitages. So there's a common practice for emperors and kings, and also for the common people, to flock in large numbers to their hermitages. So when they approach them, they have to have in their hand, they should have a small bundle of twigs, dry twigs. That's an offering which are to be used in the keeping the fire burning. That's I get. And even now, there are just a few homes in India, especially in the part of India which I'm coming from, where they preserve the fire for the last 1600, 1700 years without putting fire. So, it will be something very interesting. The same fire they would use for the marriage ceremony. And the same fire they will use for burning the bodies. So, the same fire they will use for the initiation into learning is called the sacred thread ceremony, when they reach 60 or 70. So, if you ask the question, how they could preserve this Vedantic or Vedic culture in India, it was because of this succession. Long succession. So, in fact, that explains why and how the great Greek mystery religions vanished. It did not exist. It was there during maybe Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, but it didn't continue that far. By the ancient Egyptian traditions, Babylonian, Assyrian, many of them vanished. Because the succession here means they preserve this without expecting any honor. This Vedic learning was not preserved by academics. Because if it were in the hands of academics, and academics won't care to learn anything when that particular learning doesn't bring money and wealth and status. So there's a great danger in that. Actually, suppose, now you can imagine, 19th century, in the later 19th century, later half of 19th century, maybe in the first beginning of 20th century, humanities, philosophy, history, sociology, all these topics, subjects were taught in American universities. But today, nobody is coming forward, mostly they go for management science. Suppose these branches of learning were in the hands of academics, when they become unpopular, when they don't give you, they don't guarantee, ensure wealth and position, people won't go for it. So these branches of learning were preserved by people who did not care for anything else. They lived and died for this. And for them, that is enough. That's how these things are preserved.
So it's the family that is the center of culture.
Yeah. I've seen in a, near a Jewish town in Kerala, is a old Jews. Don't know when they came. Old people, they go on studying this book. Maybe there's nobody around them who can understand what they study. But they do that, and they think that by doing that, they're doing a great thing. That's the means and the end of their life. That's how things are preserved. So things could be preserved only if we do it for its own sake. That's why academics cannot and will not preserve a tradition. And no offense meant for that. But it's a fact. You won't study something by which you know very well is not going to get you a job. Why should
So in olden days, the kings would preserve that by supporting that.
Kings, noblemen, rich men, they supported this heritage.
The fourth stage of a sannyasa ashram, which you said, which is after transit. So the two groups of people enter sannyasa ashrama then. One who transition from vanaprastha ashrama, and there are also who directly enter passing all the other two.
I'll come to that. Not all of them took to sannyasa. Okay. This is how retired people. Some of them. Now, it's called trama sannyasa, means renunciation or life by monk through succession. It's called trama sannyasa. Through succession. There's another one. There was a statement in the Vedas that anybody who feels that he or she is not interested in things of this world can take to a life of renunciation from any stage, either when you're a student, when you're a householder, when you're a traveler. So if you're brahmacharyadva, grihadva, vanadva, idakareva viraji, tadakareva pravaji, from the statement in one of the Parivrajyoga Upanishad, Nayarada Parivrajyoga Upanishad. Fine, I should translate. If a person gets a strong conviction of feeling, well, I don't want anything of this world, it's enough. He or she can take to a life of renunciation from any stage. You may be a student, you may be an old any stage of life. So, that was the. But that was not there as an institution before Shankaracharya. There were hundreds of monks you come across in the Puranic literature. Hundreds. If you read Mahabharata, it's more than 100,000 verses. You come across hundreds of monks, great sages, monks. But it was Shankaracharya who organized monasticism into a well-oiled institution in 8th century. In Hindu tradition. But in Buddhist tradition, it is Buddha himself. Remember, when Buddha became a monk, he was a Hindu monk. Jesus was a Jew after all. So, I find when Buddha became a monk, he was a Buddhist monk. You find Buddha's life, as all of you remember, 6th century BC, straight away after his illumination, when he got full knowledge, he went straight to Kashi, Sarnath. And there he found 5 Hindu monks, sometimes 8, according to different schools. And he taught them Buddhism. That is the beginning of Buddhism, actually. His first disciples were all Hindu monks. He himself was one of them. So, as an institution, it was Shankaracharya who organized monasticism. But monasticism was already there long before Buddha was born. Please, Professor.
Just a couple of thoughts, Swami. I was thinking about that book by Eric Neumann called The Great Mother. And how you were bringing out the harmony and the lack of competition and of strife in this earliest Vedic period. And could we talk just
just briefly about the matriarchal nature of this period, when there was this kind of cooperation and harmony, which reflected this belief that God, or this higher principle, is feminine, and, you know, is this Durga figure who saves and preserves and heals and transforms, instead of, you know, this more male figure that wants to fight sometimes and control. And I was just thinking about, you know, how there's probably
this
great connection.
In the Rigveda Samhita, which is the document of early Vedic life, you find both male and female archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
You find. Mm-hmm. So, you know, male and also female archetype. And then, many of these deities became monotheistic godheads during the later centuries. In Vedic, in the Rigveda Samhita, there are, you know, to begin with, it contains more than 1,000 hymns. It's called suttas.
Mm-hmm.
Every sutta or hymn may have a large number of verses. So verses, if you call it rig, and hymns, so all divided into 10 mandalas. So that's the point. Now, in all these suttas, there are Indra Sutta, Varuna Sutta, Agni Sutta, and so on. And there's Devi Sutta. Devi is a feminine divine archetype. One of the most famous suttas in Rigveda Samhita is Devi Sutta. I mean, Durga Sutta is there. So you find a number of suttas been hymns in praise of the divine archetype, both feminine and male. As to the matriarchal system of society, I can't say that this particular passage implies the system was matriarchal in nature. That must have been a later development. The succession of property, these rights and all those in matriarchal tradition, that must be a later development, and it was not the same all over the country, all over Indian subcontinent. In some places there was matriarchal system, in some were patriarchal system. But in both systems, mother played a prominent role as a central figure of family life. That's what this particular Vedanta, this very ancient statement. Mother played a prominent role in the context of family life. Succession of property rights, whether it follow the matriarchal or patriarchal system, I cannot say, because in India, there are many regions where patriarchal system prevail, there are many regions where matriarchal system prevail. But the important point is, the mother played a prominent role, and you find this throughout the later Puranic mythology, the period of mythologies and
patriarchal refer to a degradation where property is the principle rather than harmony.
Yeah. In a way, it did not imply any harmony. I think it could be that many tribes who migrated to India in later centuries brought with them their own traditions. See, India was a melting pot of, it's an anthropological museum, you know, for people from all over the world. All the Attila's friends, he was a Nihirabula. When Attila the Hun came to rest, his cousin was a Nihirabula. He came to India with his own horse. They all became Hindus. Huns, all of them. So like that, all the different anthropological racial stocks from Central Asia, a large number of today's Indian population have Greek origin, Macedonian origin. Bactria was one small picture in the Punjab region. And even today, if we go to South India, in Uti, there is a tribe it traces origin to Greeks, ancient Greeks. They look like Greeks. You find their dress code is similar to the pictures of ancient Greeks with the chadar and all. You find that. So there were so many races coming to India for centuries and mingling together, bringing their customs. They may have brought these conflicting systems of family succession, property rights.
Swami, when we talk about the early Vedic age, what years are we talking about?
Well, it could be at least 7th century BC. Before. No, you see, we have to remember the first modern Western writer who analyzed these dates was Max Muller. But Max Muller, during Max Muller's time, many of the records which are now available were not available at that time. Right now, we have to say it should be before 7th century BC. And one important document which is now quoted by historians all over the world is the disappearance of Saraswati River. So Saraswati was a river that flowed all the way from Himalayas and vanished somewhere in Rajasthan, which is the reason for the formation of Rajasthan Desert. So that river vanished, but the river is mentioned in the Vedic literature. Imam Me, Gange, Yamune, Saraswati, mentioned. So it means really Vedic times is a living river. And you find descriptions of a man, a great sage like Vyasa, meditating on the banks of the river Saraswati. It means, it was a living river. Now it must have vanished. So many historians try to trace the date even further backward. Dates are getting changed.
Swami, you spoke about studying and first learning from a teacher, then self-study and discussion, and then a more mature knowledge of a subject and the attaining of wisdom, which I interpreted you were saying that self-study brings wisdom, but where does experience come into wisdom?
So that's kind of self-study naturally, when it reaches the highest level. It naturally takes you beyond the intellectual. You start thinking of the inner essence of what you study. So it's an ancient Vedic statement, Acharya Padam Adate, Padam Shishyasvamedhya, Padam Sabhyamajari, Padam Kalakramayana. So it literally means a student learns from the teacher one-fourth what you hear, what you in the classroom. And then naturally he may work hard, he may try to understand what the teacher has taught. Then he may discuss third, and then maybe sometimes we get the real meaning of what we study in schools, maybe after retirement. It happens. Many of the higher truths, spiritual truths, we get the full implication only much later, after long contemplation. When mentally we try to leave the world of those ideas, we get the deeper implications out of those teachings. As for spiritual experience, this higher learning through contemplation, it naturally leads to experience. When you constantly ponder over one great idea, spiritual idea, naturally you graduate to experience learning. You get an experience of it. Mentally you live in the world of that idea, becomes an experience. That's what happens.
Where is it in the literature, Swami Prabhupada, but you hear about a truth,
yes.
You contemplate a truth,
yes.
And then you meditate on the truth.
Yes.
So three stages of realization. Is that a Vedic?
It's a Vedic, sir. Sravanam, Marana, Nidhyasana. It's a purely Vedic saying. Of course, this is with regard to spiritual learning.
Yes.
But actually, what I read was not necessarily related to spiritual learning alone.
Yes.
In fact, this passage which I read just now, it is very important in spiritual life, but it's directly related to normal, ordinary family life situation. This is the convocation which I read.
But you cannot separate. I mean,
no, you cannot separate. Unless you practice discipline in your family life, you cannot discipline. That's true. But I just was trying to give
the basis.
A basis.
Spiritual.
Way of life means. That's all right.
Swami, of the four things you mentioned, Imata Devobha, Pitra Devobha, Acharya Devobha, and the Atithi Devobha, I'm wondering the reason to elevate Atithi or guest to that level as opposed to anybody.
Maybe to promote the values of hospitality, broad-mindedness. Again, you know, it is the instruction is given to a student who is going back to his home to start his social life, to start his life as an absolute. So he should be hospitable to his guests, and he should be he should take care of his parents and he should be hospitable. That address continues. I read only one fraction of it. The address continues. And the teacher himself says, you may have learned many things from us, but try and to understand and practice only what you yourself convinced will work for me. Yani anavadhyani karmani tani sevidavyani noitarani. That's how teacher says, next paragraph. You may have learned many things from us. Think, and you practice in your life only those which you consider yourself as worth emanating.
There is some flexibility
here. But he said, it takes a lot of courage and broad-mindedness to say that. You don't listen to what I say, try to understand it. That's the thing. That's why I was telling, you know, the broad-mindedness, the Catholicism associated this compared to the later formal religious teacher, it's something interesting.
Exactly.
That's why sometimes we have come backward.
It seems like there was an integration of religion and everyday life.
Yeah. Exactly.
Religion wasn't consigned to these temples and
worship. Exactly.
And so there was that harmony and that oneness. Swami, I was also thinking about...
One point I want to...
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
This address must have been delivered at a time when society was more or less exclusively agrarian, and there was not large-scale urbanization going on. That's an important point. That's a discontinuity.
Oh, well, it was just the thought that several great sort of mystic scholars have talked about that fire in the early Vedas, and have talked about it as a mystic fire that just interpreted metaphysically, the fire would destroy or eliminate separation, it would eliminate hatred, hostility, and really the unreal. And so it has a deeply metaphysical aspect, doesn't it, Swami, too?
Yes, I will try to begin. I mean, it's an important question. You know, the first mantra, the first statement in the Veda Samhita is on Agni, Agni's fire. Agni Vile Guru Vidam Yetni Sudayam Yetni Sudayam Kota Arandratna Thratam. Beginning. Now, this statement, Agni means fire, is described as Purohida. Purohida actually means somebody who walked ahead of you. So, Agni or fire was considered to be the messenger, who, rather, the one who takes your offering to different deities.
The fire.
So that's why there's in Sanskrit commentary, Sayana explains Agni, Yajna Vahaka means somebody who takes what you offer in the fire to different deities.
So it would be like a mediator?
Mediator. Mediator.
Someone to help.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Now, Agni again has two symbolisms in Vedic tradition. One, it reminds you that this world of which we are very proud, and which is related to all our understanding of material prosperity, empirical, transitory, perishable things, will one day vanish, will be consumed in this fire. The other one, the fire also is a symbol of wisdom, knowledge, effulgence. So, fire has got two fundamental symbolisms. That this garuva color, this color of moon is related to that.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds you that this body, which you cover with this clothes, one day will vanish in a fire which has got the same color. So it reminds you of the perishable nature of the empirical and the imperishable nature of the Atman, the consciousness. One. The second one, and in that way it is the symbol of wisdom. Because in Vedic tradition, in the concept of the four fundamental values, there is an interesting implied wisdom, and that is where it has got great implications. Dharma is the foundation, the first one. Based on dharma, I mean the righteousness, truthfulness, etc., you follow the path of material prosperity, fulfillment of your ambitions. But then there's a risk of your looking upon this material prosperity as an end in itself. Unless you have an idea of the transcendental, you are likely to consider this perishable thing as the transcendental, as the ultimate goal. We all have a transcendental value. Even a person who wants to get high position, the 49ers get, for him the transcendental value is there, to be mighty, big footballer. So, a film artist, he has a transcendental value, to be a very famous film actor, which is really not transcendental. But once we get a glimpse of the real transcendental truth, then we'll be able to look upon the relative as relative. We will look upon the relative things as transcendent, as the ultimate. That's why moksha liberation is mentioned. You get this idea of moksha in Buddhism, in most of the religious traditions. Either you get heaven, in fact, entering heaven. In the Christian tradition, heaven is there. The heaven in Christianity is different from heaven as it is understood in Hinduism. In Hinduism, heaven is a very lower state where you have plenty of enjoyment. Depending upon the good deeds you have done, you have to come back again to be born in this world. But in Christianity, heaven is a symbolic of some kind of transcendental Christian experience, they call it, the Christian experience. So that's also a concept of liberation, of the moksha, transcendental. In all established religions, there is always some idea of a transcendental. Without that idea of a transcendental, you won't be able to live in this world.
But in Hinduism, or in the Vedic religion, there is no anthropomological.
Anthropomorphism is there, but Brahman as Atman is there. Anthropomorphism came later.
Yes.
Means giving a human dimension to the absolute reality. It came late. So these gods and goddesses, they are highly evolved souls living in the higher regions. That's the idea behind. They can listen to your prayer, they can fulfill your ambitions. But then, it's also mentioned in the Vedic, I mean, there's always the concept of the highest transcendental, which is impersonal, which is again impersonal and anthropomorphic. So I think we will continue the discussion tomorrow. So, thank you. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ram Vishnu.